The time is 8:32 a.m. on January 24, 2023, and I am convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information discussed disclosed or discussed is being used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on January 13, 2023 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. Copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of the meeting. The quorum is achieved as 6 of 8 appointed directors have been confirmed as attending in person or by video or audio conference. One director position remains vacant. Also in attendance are Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Guarantee Association Executive Director Bart Bowles, and various Guarantee Association employees, Jarrett Tearing, Topping, Haggerty, and Brandy Nichols. Also from the Texas Department of Insurance are Vane Hugo, Tina Arndahl, Lori Talley, Brian Rewey, Jeff Jones, and Sandra Salazar.
And also John Walker.
And John Walker.
Let me see. Oh, John is there. Okay.
Okay, so on to item one, consideration possible action on consent agenda items. The official minutes of the meeting of the board of directors from October 25th, 2022, and ratification of payment of notice fees and expenses for the third quarter of 2022.
The third or fourth? For Noga, it's the third.
Yeah, okay.
I'll move the consent agenda.
Ted, second.
Second.
It was
Sheraton and Huckabee.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you. Some of y'all are muted, so we didn't hear your aye, but okay, on to item number two, consideration and possible action on election of officers and appointment of members to committees to the Board of Directors.
Yes, sir. Jim, I distributed the guidelines for nominations of officers that the board has been using since 2013. And I sent an email November 1st. And I received nominations for the four officer positions, and the nominations were to maintain the same slate of officers that served in 2022. So on screen, you'll see at the top of the page, Jim Lewis is chair, Jim Harrison vice chair, James Huckabee secretary, Dean Friedler is treasurer, and you'll see how long they've served on the board and how long they've served and as an officer. And there's a
resolution. Man, I've been here a long time.
I'm sorry, Dean, you cut out just a little bit.
Oh, I've been on this board a long time, huh?
I've served quite well. We're glad you're still there.
2007, I was just a wee lad then. Okay. Are we waiting for a motion?
I have placed a stable resolution on screen. You just need to fill in the blanks for the four positions.
I'll move the current slate of officers again for the upcoming year.
This is Dean. I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? The slate passes. And just as a reminder, when you make a motion, state your name for the recording. Okay. Committee members.
What you have on screen, Jim, are the standing committees for 2022, executive committee, assessment, investment, audit, personnel. And we still have the audit. We still have the ad hoc corporate governance committee in place. It did a substantial amount of work early on in, I guess that was 2020. And we've kept it in place as we implemented some of their suggestions since that time. So it's continuing to serve, and we've left it in place if you would like to appoint and maintain that ad hoc committee.
So maybe we can put Mark on a committee?
I was going to suggest that.
I'm willing to go off of any committee because I'm on two or three, I guess, but one I have to be on.
Well, deference goes to the chair. Is there one that you really enjoyed and like to stay on?
How about Mark? Do you have a preference of personnel or audit or really any of them?
No, sir. Willing to serve wherever you put me, Jim.
Well, I've been on the audit committee forever. Want to be on the audit?
Certainly.
This is Dean. We'd love to have Mark on the audit committee.
So is that the only change that you are recommending?
Does anybody else want to make a change? Is there anyone who's not on a committee? Okay, well,
we have a resolution with blanks, but I can leave this on screen and just again make these appointments with the adjustment of replacing James Lewis on the audit committee with Mark Williams.
And the board approves the committees, or is it just me?
You can appoint them, but we've always done
okay.
A resolution just to have a good record.
Okay. We have a motion to appoint. Well, I'll make a motion since I suggested it to
put it back on screen for you.
To leave the committee members the same, except to replace me on the audit committee with Mark Williams.
This is James Huckabee. I second.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. And then I guess we're on to item number three, consideration of possible action regarding any matters presented by the Texas Department of Insurance.
Yeah, Vane, I think maybe we discussed you have a number of new team members. You'd like to introduce any of the new TDI personnel?
Sure. Jeff Jones just recently joined our team. Tina, she's been a regular attendee at board meetings for a while. Lori Talley and John Walker, they're our receivership analyst, and they've joined the meeting just to kind of round out their understanding of what all happens. We have Brian Rewey and Sandra Salazar from the Office of Financial Counsel. And did I get everybody?
I think that's everyone.
I think maybe it's your Wi-Fi connection that's bad.
I don't know why. We're getting a little on the sound. You cut out just a little bit, but everyone is. And I turned the volume down just a little bit.
Well, everybody's cutting out. I would bet it's your Wi-Fi connection.
Building Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Okay, well, do we need to move on to item number four?
That's good.
Consideration and possible action on reports and recommendations from the Personnel Committee.
Mr. Huckabee.
Yeah. James, you're up.
Thank you. Let me unmute. Okay, we met on January 10th, 2023. Thank you, board. You see the reports, the report up on your screen. You should see it. And the items that are underlined are the items that we discussed in our meeting. One item that we will have some discussion on, would that be an executive board, just comments on the evaluation of the executive director? Is that correct?
Yes.
What's public and what? But as far as the process, you guys are all familiar with, all eight directors were distributed an evaluation form to have completed in mid-December. Our evaluation of board's performance for the calendar year. There were nine. Do we talk about the scored categories in executive, or is that public board?
I think we should hold any discussion of my performance for executive session. It falls under the category of personnel evaluations. There are just a couple of items here that the personnel committee might want to just read into the record on some of their discussion. James, do you would like me to run through a couple of those and let you add on?
Yes, sir, if you would.
Okay. Well, the committee, as they do annually, did look at the benefits, compensation, and training elements that are included in the operating budget. As part of that, there is my recommendations on adjustments and some compensation for staff. We will review that in detail during an executive session. But I do talk about each employee, but that is approved by the board later on the agenda when the board is asked to consider the operating budget for 2023. There's no specific action on salaries. It's included in the budget. We did fill the position of our office assistant on December 1st. Brandy Nichols began working in our office. She had served for about 600 hours as a temporary, and we found that she's very capable and a nice fit within our office, and we're so glad to have Brandy. On my performance, we talked that that be done in executive session, but there were a couple of elements in my contract that are automatic that we always like to report. One is my base compensation, and that is adjusted annually based on the cost of living adjustment from the Social Security Administration. So I always provide the press release on that adjustment to the personnel committee. Usually that comes out in mid-October. So by November 1st, I send it to the committee. And then the committee did discuss it again January 10th. But as of January 1st, my compensation changed by that cost of living adjustment of 8.7%. In addition to that, there is a greater contribution to a 457B plan in addition to 401k. There's a 457B plan for me. There's a automatic adjustment or contribution of $18,500. Anything above that amount and up to the maximum permitted by the Internal Revenue Service is discretionary, and the personnel committee did discuss that, and I believe they have a recommendation to review with the board at the session. Cross-training and succession. I did provide a list to the personnel committee. We reviewed it in detail. I had, at their prior meeting, reviewed the succession plans that we have in our business continuity plan and asked if there wanted to, the committee wanted to explore any expansion of the succession plan or possibly entering into an interim emergency services agreement. So if something were to happen to me, they would have someone under contract to step in and fill my role. I believe the committee very appropriately said, we have a lot of these processes documented. Let's just make sure we have those activities, that there's cross-training among the existing staff. And we make sure that in any vendors that we have in place, that there are more than one person that has contact with those vendors, have authority to interact and take steps with that vendor. So I went through a list of all the, what I call vital activities of the association and the vendors providing services there. And the committee had a little bit of feedback, but I think they thought it was a, well, it's a living list. It will continue to grow and be expanded, but we're in process of making sure that we have cross-training on every activity and we have at least two people working with every vendor. So beyond that, that's all I have in the personnel committee other than what we're going to talk in the executive session. James, did I misstate anything?
No, sir. Well done. Thank you very much.
That's all on item four, Chair Lewis.
Okay. Then item five is consideration of possible action on reports and recommendations from the assessment investment committee meeting. That's Dean.
Nope, that's James.
I'm sorry, James.
Jim
Harrison. I'm losing it.
So the assessment investment committee did meet earlier this month. All members, myself, Ted, and Dean were present. We did all the things that the committee normally does at the meeting. We reviewed the cash flow projections for active insolvencies, reviewed association investments, investment policy, and talked about the need for assessments or refunds in 2023. We spent most of our time, though, talking about what to do with the Lincoln Memorial Service Funds. As I think the board knows, we have some litigation recoveries that were substantial. So with respect to that, I guess at the last meeting, the committee and the board directed Bart and staff to take some actions with regards to those funds. I don't know, Bart, you want to report on what you did?
Yes, I will. There was a little more robust written material provided to the personnel committee, and I'll just read past a couple of items from that list. As you recall, at the July 12th meeting, the committee has a recommendation that they then made to the board of directors on July 26th, and the board adopted four specific actions they asked staff follow up to regarding the Lincoln Memorial Funds. The first item they asked is to confirm with the Texas Comptroller the balances of any available premium tax credit related to the four assessments that have been levied and collected for Lincoln Memorial Services. Those four assessments were $114 million. We did contact the Comptroller. We found out there were, I believe, Jarrett, 63 companies that had available premium tax credits, well over $505,000. On September 1st and 2nd, Jarrett issued checks to those companies to pay them for the premium tax credits they had not yet taken. And then we advised the comptroller of the payments we made, and the comptroller eliminated the availability of those premium tax credits for those 63 companies. We had reported to the committee that there were 10 checks that were not negotiated as part of the timing through the bank have were voided. We reissued them. As of yesterday, we have only 7 checks out of the 63 that have not been negotiated by member companies. Those checks totaled $32,438.91. So of the $114 million of assessments that then became available tax credits, only 38,000 of benefits still remain. We'll keep trying to pay those to the member companies. It's interesting that one company's mailroom keeps sending us back a check and a notice saying we don't know what policy to apply this premium to. So it takes some explanation. Well, that's item one. The second thing the committee asked us to do was to fund the remaining 2021 administrative expense shortfall and the 2022 administrative expenses from the Lincoln Memorial Funds. And when I say administrative expenses, these were the expenses not related to specific insolvency or for a troubled company that we've not yet had the ability to do a Class G assessment. So these fall in the category. If they were not funded from the Lincoln Memorial Funds, we would be doing a Class A assessment. So We did pay a little over $1.2 million in remaining 2021 admin expenses. And then as of the end of November, so that's the last month that the financials have been closed, a little over $2 million in admin expenses in 2022. So it's $3.23 million were paid in for the admin expenses from these Lincoln Mobile funds. That was the second action step. The third action step was to reinvest any maturing investments of Lincoln Memorial Memorial Service funds into treasuries with a September 30th, 2023 maturity date. Why September 30th? We have a few remaining tasks to complete involving recovery on Lincoln Memorial Memorial Service. I will talk about those in just a moment, but the details I'll provide in the executive session. We're hopeful we can get tasks completed by the July meeting, the Assessment Investment Committee, and they may have another recommendation to do something with some of the assessments, the Memorial Service and Lincoln Memorial Funds. That could be implemented in the fall. So we've just targeted, let's have all those funds mature in September 2023 and be prepared to take any actions directed by the board based on committee recommendation. And the last item four was continue to monitor the collection of remaining litigation proceeds and report back to the committee when we have those resolved. There's been an update there. Let me just touch on them in general and then provide a little bit of more detail. We'll get to executive session because it does involve some sensitive legal matters. There were funds collected in the litigation that have been held at Nolan that are ready to be distributed. But we also have future cash flows coming from three assets from these. They involve Hollywood Forever and the settlement we initiated with them. Some policies from a company called American Memorial that the litigating parties now own after a settlement we did with Bremen Bank. And then there's a small stream of recoveries coming from restitution from the criminal defendants. All three of those streams are going to go over sometime in the future. So Jackie and I have been working with the Litigation Oversight Committee of Guaranty Associations and with specifically between the Texas and Missouri Guaranty Associations to try to come up with a resolution to take especially the receiver and our litigating law firm, the Riley Law Firm, to take your interest out of those assets. So it would just be the guarantee associations going forward to be a little easier to deal with, and it will allow the leadership to stay here in Texas to move toward closing. So I'm going to provide some additional color on these assets and those cash flow streams when we get the executive session. It's a little bit sensitive because they are a part of settlements, but we think we have a means to resolve these. And I have a meeting later this week. I think we can get a lot closer to getting to a resolution. If everything goes well, we get the July meeting, I think we can put a bow on these things. But we'll talk about it in more detail in that session. But that's going to close out the four actions that the committee asked us to take. Where are we right now in Lincoln Memorial Funds? We are holding, as of November 30th, our current net position is approximately $44.4 million. And so that just gives you a summary of actions we've taken and where we are with the Lincoln Memorial monies.
Thank you, Bart. As Bart said, there'll be some additional discussion, executive session about those funds, and we will have an action item arising out of that later in public session. Thank you for that. Mr. Chairman, the report is concluded.
Okay. Item number six is consideration of possible action regarding the annual board of directors self-evaluation. And Shelby is going to help us out with that.
All right. As you will recall, in mid-November, in November, I sent to each director the board self evaluation questionnaire for completion. In December, I received from every serving director a completed questionnaire. And in your board books, you have the composite results of those completed questionnaires. I'm going to go through them very briefly. There are three questions in the questionnaire, and then at the end, there's kind of a catch-all. Tell us anything else you think is important to share with regard to the board's performance. The first question asks for comments on how much time the board spends, its teamwork, and its overall contributions to the association. I think it's fair to say that the board scored about an 8+ on this particular question. And that would be a grade that I, as your board counsel, would agree with. It was virtually unanimous that the board works very well as a team, that every board member is very diligent and conscientious and engaged and spends the appropriate amount of time on board activities. There's no one who is not pulling their weight as a board member. So on that, there really was no variance in opinion. Question two was adoption, review, and observance of corporate governance. And again, I think the board recognized that it does an exceptional job in this regard. And by my observation, the board not only talks the talk, it walks the walk. The board has developed over the years a robust set of corporate governance provisions. And not only has it developed documentation of these provisions, but it actually implements them and lives them. So that, again, everybody was of the same mind and as I was. I mean, it's summarized, the board is diligent about corporate governance in every way. The third question was a relatively new question that I think I added during the pandemic. And it was just suggestions if anyone on the board thought there was a need for any other kind of board training. And the consensus opinion was pretty much nothing added to the formal board training that directors get at the outset of the of their service, as well as during their service. One suggestion was continued education about the nuts and bolts of receivership and related NOLGA processes would be helpful. And I think Bart and Jackie do a good job of doing that kind of on a continual basis by going into the nuts and bolts of what happens pre-liquidation and the rehab process and various notable rehabilitations and what happens after it migrates inevitably into the liquidation and then what over the years of that. So I think that is a great suggestion, and I think it's already really being historically has been covered. There is also a suggestion in under section 3, which really isn't for board training, but the suggestion was maybe revisiting having the annual self-evaluation. And just read, this is the only guarantee association board I participate in that undertakes this process, this annual self-evaluation. While possibly a helpful exercise on a periodic every 5 years basis, I'm not a fan of doing this annually. I believe that most boards' issues, concerns are dealt with on an ad hoc basis as they arrive, which is a testament to the entire board and staff, but I believe mitigates the need for this annual solicitation. So this general comment has come up before. Do we need to do this? And my view is this is a good corporate governance practice. Certainly, when you establish a nonprofit organization, the IRS, not a nonprofit organization, a tax-exempt organization such as the association, the IRS asks, do you have an annual self-evaluation process? So I think it's pretty universally understood to be a good thing. But I do think it could be done in a different manner, such as the one as the author suggests. An option would be to have a standing issue on the agenda for any board management issues, similar to the standing issue that the board has for personnel matters without BART present. I don't think it's, you know, handed down in a stone tablet that you have to have an annual evaluation. So the board can consider altering the process. Another thing that came to mind is, as I was nagging people for completing their questionnaires, sorry about that, folks, I recognized, well, gosh, not only are you filling out this board self-evaluation, you're filling out Bart's evaluation, you're filling out Jackie's evaluation, you're filling out my evaluation, you're coming up with recommendations for board officers and committee assignments, and it's all during the holiday season and end of the year, which is for most people a rather busy time of year. So another consideration might, I've always thought it's neat and tidy to think back on a calendar year basis, close in time to the end of the year, because it's fresh in your memory. But you could break up the due dates for some of these reports. So with that said, I'll let Bart, Jackie, and any board member have their say, and if any board member feels inclined to make a motion to change the process, this would be the time.
I will offer a comment on the continuing education on the nuts and bolts of receivership. This has come up in our system, the Guarantee Association system, recently. I don't know, I may have even thrown it out there. We've had, I think it's 25 new administrators in the last year and a half in the Guarantee Association system. And those executive directors and administrators of the Guarantee Associations have been consumed with getting their arms around their operations. How do I run a Guarantee Association? And they have had zero exposure on insolvencies. How does an insolvency work? How does NOLGA work? What the heck do we NOLGA dues? What's an MPC? So the MPC Executive Committee, we have discussed breaking up these activities into groups, NOLGA functions, MPC and insolvency task force processes, receiverships, break them up into these different categories and build out a curriculum on each one, and then do some online recorded training modules that people can go, mainly the administrators can go and view at their leisure and learn. I've been appointed to an insolvency task force. What am I supposed to do? What's the function, role, and responsibilities and authority of a task force? Something like that. Those can also be available to the directors on the individual Guarantee Associations boards. So that's something in development, and it's a kind of a self-study, so to speak. So that may answer this need that was highlighted in the review.
Yeah, and in the next agenda item, I'm going to give the annual refresher on fiduciary duty. And I think that it'll be my third time doing this. And I think all the directors are probably basically familiar with the material. And so you might even consider going forward doing that every other year. And then on the off years, take up one of the topics that Bart suggested, or anything, any substantive area that was timely at the time. I mean, I think.
So is Mark heard that?
Mark Williams?
Yeah.
I think in your board training, you got trained on fiduciary duties.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, I did. Very well. So, I did.
There's going to be a test, Mark. Yeah. Just, no, but I mean, I don't think it has to be an hour or 30 minutes. It can be kind of a 15-minute segment. You know, over the years, you learn a lot that way. So
I didn't mean to get in front of the board, but I didn't want to forget my thought there when this continuing education came up. I'm just curious if anyone from the board would like to add to the self-evaluation.
That wasn't my suggestion, but I kind of wondered if it was really necessary to do it every year. But I understand the IRS asking it, but if it's not a regulation, it requires it. It doesn't matter if they ask it.
It's not any kind of requirement. And I will say, of the boards I have seen and observed, this board does an exceptional job of documented good corporate governance practices and following them. So
5 years seems kind of long. Just from the standpoint, I don't even know how long our appointments are.
There's
six.
Yeah. I mean, 3 years might be more appropriate. But I don't know what everybody else thinks.
This is Jackie. I have a couple of comments I'd like to contribute. You know, it's the 990, the IRS 990 form that asks about, is there an annual self-evaluation of the board? And that's something that the 990 you have to fill out every year. And even though it is not a requirement, I think at this point, in terms of governance of not-for-profit or tax-exempt entities, it is considered a best practice. And but, so
this is.
But does it say annual, Jackie? I mean, I think
it does.
This is Jarrett. I'm actually looking through the 990 right now because I don't recall that question being in there, and I cannot find it in the 990 specifically asking about a board evaluation. There's questions about whistleblower policy, document retention, destruction, ethics policy, written conflict of interest policy, but nothing about board evaluations.
I think the confusion may be there is an aspect of the 990. Was this form reviewed by the board or the governing body of the entity? So the 990.
That's for the 990, Bart.
That's just the 990.
Yeah. Well, I could be wrong about that. I'm actually also thinking about other nonprofits that I've been involved with and in as a result of becoming more aware of the requirements of the 990s was when they, you know, implemented the annual evaluation of the board. And I could be wrong that it's annual. I think it is, but I could be wrong on that.
I do agree, though, that the
method of doing it and whether it's the same questions every year and that sort of thing, I certainly think there's lots of flexibility in there. And I agree with Shelby that, you know, it's a lot of questionnaires to answer in the month of December. And one thing that has occurred to me before is whether a way to simplify some of this might be to use something like SurveyMonkey or some kind of, a third party survey form that generally can be easier to work through than responding to an email.
Hi, this is Ted. I'll fess up and say that's my comment. And I kind of stand by it with respect to how the other four boards I sit on handle themselves. I appreciate the 990 concern. But if we're just looking to check an IRS box, you know, I would say, can it be as simple as a line item in one of our three board meetings and have an affirmation in person that would take 1 minute? Are there any issues or any concerns? No, hearing none, done. We check the box for the IRS. My view is we deal with these issues as they arise on an ad hoc basis, as I stated, and it's somewhat, if not redundant, non-substantive to go through the process at your end. I, for one, I don't know if others do, don't go back and recount anything that we may have discussed over the year to determine definitively whether we should include that in this solicitation. So for me, it's just a process that is busy work, frankly. But I agree it's a best practice. I agree we need to represent. I'm just wondering if there's an easier, better way, more efficient way to do it rather than a formal solicitation. Maybe SurveyMonkey, maybe it's as simple as a 30-second discussion at one of our board meetings.
Well, what is people's reaction to having the standing agenda item to where the issue I've always had with, you know, any kind of performance evaluation, I would hope if anyone had a problem, that would the issue would be surfaced immediately, not wait a year to say, oh, you know, we really should do this better. And I think you could make the case that we have a formal process of every meeting. There is the ability for a director to have notified counsel or BART that, hey, we have this issue with board management and it can be dealt with in real time when the concern arises. And if there are no concerns, that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. But people know there's that availability to, on a regular basis, surface any issue. And in my view, that's certainly a board self-evaluation, but the evaluation may be we think we're doing things great right now.
I'd kind of be curious. This is other than my company's boards, this is the only board I serve on. Does anyone else? I know you serve on multiple boards.
Yeah, I'm on four boards, and have been on a couple others before. We don't have none of my other boards have a process like this.
Okay.
It didn't take a lot of my time, probably more of Shelby's time to say, Jim, where the heck is your, I kind of agree with Ted. I don't see this in other places. It sounds like an annual evaluation is best practice. So I think we have to incorporate that somehow. If there's a way to maybe work it into a meeting as a,
just make an agenda
standing,
item.
Yeah, then that might be an easier way to go for everybody and more timely, I guess.
This is James Duckman. I'd like to just share a couple comments on that. It does not require a lot of time to complete it. However, the time window that I think board council evaluations, I believe every other year, but everything was just compacted during a holiday season. So it doesn't take a lot of time. I think SurveyMonkey or some other tool might be making an easier process. The next thing, in regard to having it every board agenda, depending on what topic is brought up, that has the ability to lengthen the meeting. I know there are several of you that fly into the meetings when you attend, but that's the challenge. If you put it on every agenda, board meeting agenda, then limiting the time, that would be the concern. What would that add? And it sounds pretty simple, but if someone brings up an issue that we're going to discuss, it could potentially lengthen our meeting and create a conflict with other obligations we have. And then some people who might be relatively new to the board might have a tendency not to want to voice that openly. You have public members and industry members.
those of us who are in public sector, it took a little bit of time to fully understand the association. And you might have someone that's public who, you know, this is our first, you know, I guess when I came on the board, it was like, okay, here's a new language I have to learn. Certainly understand insurance, property casualty, and health insurance and those type things from a public sector organization. So that would be the concern, eliminating it totally. Could it be every other year? Absolutely. Could it be done at a different time of the year? Absolutely. But to have it as a standard agenda item,
I don't think we were suggesting doing it four times a year. We were suggesting doing it once a year on as an agenda item, unless I misunderstood.
Well, that's certainly one variation. Or on every agenda that BART prepares, there is an item that says an executive session, personnel with the executive director, personnel without the executive director. I can't remember the last time we used one of those agenda items, but it's there. And if you know, there the need arose to have that. And to me, the only impetus for having it a standing agenda item is that you take care of an issue when it arises, as opposed after the fact.
Yeah, I got to be honest. When I first became chair, we had an issue, and I got on the phone and called Shelby, and I called Jackie, and talked with Bart, but maybe that's just me. I didn't have any problem doing that. I've been on the board a while, I'll admit that, but.
Let us explore, maybe put our heads together a little bit, some ways. And I do appreciate the conflagration there. Well, all these reports at year end that maybe we can spread them throughout the year. I do remember the last time we had a discussion without me present. It's before COVID when we were doing in-person meetings. And I would routinely just leave the room automatically to give you a chance to talk without me being there. It's a little difficult when I'm the host and to leave a meeting when I'm trying to make sure everyone stays connected. So let us explore some ways to do this and some alternatives for doing it, having self-evaluation and board members' comments collected regularly without having to go through this process anyway.
Right. I mean, at least the scheduling
we can
be.
I have Zoom meetings all the time. I think I can handle you being out of the room and the Zoom meeting works.
Well, and I make talking the host. I think she could too, but yeah. You know, I'm a control freak. You know that.
Well, yeah, this is Dean. This is Dean, and I question why the board does Jackie's evaluation anyway. I really think that's Bart's job to do. Now, Shelby is board counsel, so I kind of understood that one, but I thought Jackie was not something we should be doing.
Let's talk about that in executive session, because we're going to be going over those evaluations. If we may, Dean, can I postpone that?
That'll be fine. Thank you.
Save your thought. And Shelby, if I may, our next item, I want to see, because we're going to have a scheduling issue here. Bain, what time do you have to leave the meeting?
I have to leave at 10 o'clock. My other meeting is scheduled for an hour, but it typically doesn't last quite that long.
Well, I have a suggestion, and here's the issue. Bain has a very important meeting he needs to attend, but I also would like him to be in part of the discussion. We're going to have an executive session. To make sure we don't miss that, I'd like to go ahead and move to out of order and take executive session now.
Sure.
And then come back to item 7. Jackie, do you have any issues with doing that?
Nope, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, so if we could take it out of order, and Jim, you read the language and topic, you tell us what we need to do. So, Bain, I think we can handle most of the things you need to be involved with.
40 minutes?
Yeah, in those 40 minutes.
Okay. Sure.
All right. Let's do that if we don't mind.
Okay, the time is 9:22 a.m. on January 24th, 2023, and I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. The time is 11:08 a.m. on January 24th, 2023, the executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And I believe that means we're on the agenda item 11.
We do need to take that action, but we also then need to go back at one point to a couple items we skipped. But if you want to do agenda item first, number 11.
Okay. Yeah, so we have a resolution for the 457B plan payment to the executive director. You can see it there on the screen. We have a motion.
Mark Williams, so moved.
James Huckabee, second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. The resolution passes. And then we have the resolution on the management of the Link Memorial Service Funds.
So, Jim Harrison, I'll make that motion with one minor fix. Numbered paragraph 4, second and third line should read remaining recoveries from illiquid assets.
This is Ted. I'll second the motion as amended.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. Resolution passes.
We can go back to item 7 on the agenda. Let me skip to move to executive session.
Oh,
yes.
Fiduciary duties. You want me to get started, Chairwoman?
Sure. Yes. Sorry. Item 7. Thanks, Jackie.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give the brief annual update on your fiduciary duty training. As you'll recall, the corporate governance ad hoc corporate governance committee suggested this would be a good idea. I think it's about the third time that some of you have heard this. So, as I mentioned before, I think a lot of you will be hopefully very familiar with this material. I'm going to talk about three fiduciary duties that you're subject to. They're not found in TPC, the Life Association's governing statute or its plan of operation. They're found in case law, judgment law, legal precedents, which there is a very well-established robust body of law that imposes these types of fiduciary duties on governing boards. And I believe would definitely be applied to this association. The first one that I'm going to take up is the fiduciary duty of due care. It's pretty straightforward. That means when the board meets to make decisions, when it engages in activities or is managing the association, it has to act in good faith with ordinary care. And by ordinary care, I mean the care that a reasonable person would do in similarly situated circumstances. And the person has to act in the manner that he or she reasonably believes to be in the best interests of the organization. that's pretty much the CLE version of the duty. What directors should remember is that when you're governing the association, when you're making decisions, you have to make informed decisions, which means you need to consider relevant information and to the best of your business acumen and judgment, and in good faith, you make a decision. And if you do that, you'll be protected what's known as the business judgment rule, and your decisions or decision, whether it's to do something actively or decide not to do something, you will not incur any liability so long as you comply with the duty of care, fiduciary duty. What's the practical advice for the directors for making sure they comply with this? Read your board books, read your committee meeting materials that board and the rest of the staff send around, and read the information that Bart provides to you between meetings by email, his interim reports and emails. He has curated for you, and the staff has curated for you all of the information that you need to make good, well-based, informed decisions. So that's the practical advice on that duty. The second duty we're going to talk about is the duty of loyalty. That's a pretty straightforward one. That simply means that you have to put the interests of the association above your interests. So you don't want to engage in a conflict of interest. If the director has a personal or financial stake in some matter, some activity, some decision the board's going to make, that person should come forward immediately and tell Bart that, or you can tell counsel that, so that before the matter goes any further, the person with a conflict is removed from the discussion. Oftentimes we ask that person to step outside or in the Zoom waiting room, while the remaining disinterested directors can take the matter up and make a decision. So when you have practical advice, when you have that conflict, tell Bart, tell counsel, make sure you're not participating in the discussion. You can't vote on that. And the important thing is to get that sorted out before the matter goes forward or the discussion commences. That's the duty of loyalty in a nutshell. The last fiduciary duty is the duty of obedience. The name of that duty is, I think, a little less intuitive than the prior two. But it's obedience to the fundamental corporate governance documents of the organization. So what the duty requires a director to do is act in accordance with, be faithful to all of the provisions pertaining to boards that are found in the association's governing statute, what are found in the association's plan of operation, and all of the robust policies and procedures for corporate governance that the board has adopted. So if you follow the law and follow your own procedures, you should be good to go. And that, in a nutshell, are what those three fiduciary duties mean. You want to go straight into duties of counsel? Or
I just say something?
Absolutely.
I started attending industry meetings in my 20s, and I always had questions, and I would raise my hand and ask questions, and people would come up afterwards saying, I'm so glad you asked that. I wasn't comfortable asking. That should not be the case here. Anybody has a question where they don't understand why we're doing something, or if they want to make sure that we're following our law or the statute or our governing documents, just raise your hand and ask. It is not a big deal. Somebody else is probably thinking the same thing.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to add that.
Did anyone have any questions about fiduciary duties?
Okay, let's go on to the review of counsel's individual duties.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try and do this rapidly. I know we've had a very full agenda this morning. Essentially, the duty of board counsel, I would say the overarching reason you have board counsel is if the board would like an independent source to go to for all matters that pertain to the board. I have a much smaller subset of duties than does Jackie. Jackie does everything for the association. I really don't get involved on whether a claim is covered by the act or how the association is going to interface with the SDR on any insolvency. My role is to worry about, is the board performing the duties that are imposed by law and by its corporate governance? So second bullet, I assist, make sure you follow statute, follow common law, like the fiduciary duties in all your policies and procedures. I can verify that by assisting with board training to make sure people are fully aware of the duties that they have. I attend board meetings to make sure that people are in fact following the procedures, the law that are applicable to them. I assist in the preparation and updating of corporate governance, especially which pertains to the responsibilities of the board. I assist with negotiating contractual arrangements with the executive director. Happily, that won't happen for 5 years, we think, Bart. We were trying to figure that out. But, yep. Certainly doing the annual, historically, the annual performance reviews. I assist with the board's self-evaluation, as we've just been discussing earlier in the meeting. And from time to time, individual board members have called me up with questions, and that's really what a board counsel is always available for, to answer any questions that you have related to your board service. And on request, I can do anything else that the board specifically asks. That, very shortly put, is essentially what I do. And I think, I guess, at the end of the presentation, Jackie will give input on her busy schedule for attending to the association's matter in our matters, and our contact info is at the end of the presentation. So, Jackie?
Yes, I'm back now. We had the power went out for a bit, so... Nothing was going on, but thankfully it's back. So as Shelby said, my duties as the general counsel are broader in scope. And my client is the entity, the Guarantee Association, which includes the board and the staff in carrying out the Guarantee Association functions. And so when I am doing anything for the association, I'm not thinking just about, how does this affect Bart and staff? I'm thinking about how does this affect the board and how does this affect the association as a whole as well. And so some of the things that I do is I represent the association in domestic and foreign receiverships, provide legal advice about the interpretation of our governing statute regarding coverage, claims determination, disputed claims, litigation claims, reinsurance, third-party matters, and assessment issues. Really, any questions that come up as to how to interpret the statute or something that comes up in the course of an insolvency or anything else. I also attend all the board and committee meetings and negotiate, review, and draft contracts of an insurance nature as well as not insurance, for example, leases, IT agreements, and other agreements. And for those of you who may not know, my practice besides representing the Guarantee Association is a general business corporate sort of practice. And I do a lot of this kind of work for other clients as well. I also locate and screen outside counsel as and when needed, provide advice and drafting of documents related to corporate governance, providing advice on employment matters, employee policies, and the employee handbook, monitoring changes to the Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Model Act, and drafting or providing information when there are going to be revisions to the statute. And I also keep an eye on, you know, anything else that might be going on that possibly could affect the Guarantee Association from a legislative standpoint. And then I provide other services or advice as requested by the executive director or the board. And as with Shelby, there have been, you know, times where board members will call me with questions about, you know, what is this, you know, what is this that we're talking about, or what does it mean when we are talking about this, or, you know, why do we have a general counsel and a board counsel? And so I'm always happy to answer those kinds of questions as well.
Thank you, Jackie.
Sure.
And we always like to stress here, these duties and this contact information is posted on the board portal, and all directors should always remember they can go directly to council at any time by phone, by mail, or email with any questions, concerns, or any needs they have. You do not need to come through me. I'm not a screen or a filter. You can go directly to council anytime you want. And please don't forget that. And Jim, that's all we have under this item.
Yeah, and I will say that they've been very helpful to me over the years. When I became chair, I was real uncomfortable with how awkward it is to have to change the chair, and that I wanted people to always feel comfortable if they wanted to be chair. I don't really care about being chair, and they're welcome to it. And so I discussed those things with Shelby and Jackie, and that's why y'all get an email from me every year saying feel free to ask for a nomination and I'll nominate you. But they have been very helpful when I've had questions about Guarantee Association matters. Is there item number 8? Is there an action?
No,
there is no action item.
That was just to introduce it. Since we were already in executive session, we dealt with the evaluation of board counsel and general counsel during the executive session. So moving on to item 9. It's brief.
Right. Number 9, please, Bart.
And so you'll recall that 3 years ago, I was asked by the personnel committee to draft the critical functions report, we call it now, but it's processes and procedures for critical functions of the association. And really what this is, it's a document that if you put this with the business continuity plan and the policy and procedure manual, someone can pick up those documents and manage the association. It is a little bit of a brain dump, not only the things that have to be done, but what are the tools, which staff provide what functions, and if there's special checklists or files that we use, where are they located, how can they be found. There were substantial changes made last year, but in my review of the critical function report, I had no changes to make to it this year. So this is just the annual report. Is there anything I've identified that needs to be adjusted? And there is none. And we've done the executive session. So
that was on the portal.
Excuse me?
That was on the portal.
The critical function report isn't on the portal.
I think so.
I don't believe it is.
The only reason I ask is if something happened and the board had to.
Let us make a note of that, because there ought to be we could add that into the governance section. We have a lot of governance documents up there. Let me just make sure whether we will have to check it.
I'm 90% sure it is, but I would not expect that.
Yeah, at my company, we often joke that if I was hit by a bus, how would we take care of it? And so having that on the portal might be helpful. Okay.
And so with what you've already done on executive session and matters after executive session, we're up to item 12.
Okay, number 12.
Just Mark. There's a couple things I'll mention in my report. We are on the follow-up of financial audit. One thing to tell you there are the various things we told the audit committee we'll do. And Dean, you will appreciate this. Jarrett and I had a conversation with Eddie Muir, an actuary here with Rudd & Wisdom, about the process I use monthly to project our obligations for insolvencies. We walked through all of those obligation projections with Eddie. He actually felt that part of it, we should be relying more heavily on reserves, and he actually was provided us with some techniques to adjust them a little better. We provided him with the year-end obligations, and he has already provided us with a letter saying that the process used to prepare and project these obligations is reasonable and appropriate. So we have a letter already in hand to provide to the auditors for year-end 22. Second thing, we're ongoing in our examination with the Department of Insurance. We've provided a flood of documents, and we continue to get requests, so that exam continues. I sent a letter, as you requested, to Commissioner Brown requesting access to the Department of Insurance ICANN system. Bain and I then talked about that. Bain asked for a little more detail on the needs and uses of the system, and if we had that information, how would it impact operations? So we provided Bain with a narrative of that and some examples of prior screen prints from the ICANN system, and tried to point out where that information was valuable, and we could obtain the data with a few clicks rather than repeated in a long line of open records requests. And Bain and I have been discussing, and I believe, Bain, where we are, we're in the process of trying to schedule a meeting.
That's correct.
And I will let the board know, we have discussed this in-house, and we have, of course, decided that access to the ICANN system is our priority, would be the best result. But compared to where we are now of doing open records requests, we maybe have some alternatives between the two, but we need to understand more fully the concerns with access first before anything else is thrown on the table. So we look forward to that meeting with TDI. Next item, vacancy on the board of directors. We heard from Caitlin Merrick just recently that a potential candidate has been screened and gone through, at least progressed to the interview process at TDI. So we may be closer to having a new public member. So that is progress. We'll see where that goes. And the last report is just about some meetings I've attended. And there's, of course, upcoming meetings the rest of this week. We'll be in Florida for meetings of NOLGA. Next week, I'll be at a conference of IAIR in Savannah. And that's all I have for the executive director report.
What's the deadline on the TDI examination?
There's no deadline. The examiner.
Sure.
The examiner.
For companies, there's always a deadline where they have to get it done by a certain date.
We've only been told that this exam could go through the first quarter of this year.
Okay. I mean, there's a statutory deadline for insurance companies.
Maybe we'll fall into that.
Okay. On to item 13.
There's not a lot to me. I'm going to save some time. And on these reports, if you've read something in the report that you'd like to ask a question, please do so. There's our obligations. I do want to point out one thing you haven't seen in a while. The complaint log. You haven't seen the complaint log in 11 years because we hadn't had a complaint. We had a complaint. And the complaint was filed with TDI. It was written to the Texas Life Health Insurance Guarantee Association. So it had to be sent to us and it had to be reported. The consumer was complaining that, why was I issued this policy? I never asked for it. It had nothing to do with the association. Yes. It is not justified. There was nothing for us to respond to, but I did. I sent a letter, but it had in our guidelines, it's a complaint, but it is nothing against the association, nothing the association did, but there went our perfect record. So, sorry.
It's a little unbelievable that you haven't had any. I don't mean, I'm not picking on y'all.
Even ones like that, we don't overlook them. We haven't had any.
We get ones where they want to file a claim, but that didn't require a complaint. send us the documents.
We might be nicer to people. I don't know.
I doubt it.
I want to point out some numbers on pinching and give you a couple items here. They're moving. There you can see as of the end of December, the system has paid out. If you look at the claims, payments, and cash buyouts, $1.46 billion. That's a lot of money out the door. Collected $500 million in premiums. We still have, as a system, 37,000, almost 38,000 policies in force and 4,000 open claims for Texas, 2,000 open policies and almost 300 claims. So the association had funded through LTC Re right at $79 million. In benefits. That's a large insolvency. I want to point out the wellness pilot program. We're 1 year into it and we are evaluating results now. We've had very good positive comments from the consumers. They're happy with the service they get. They're happy with some of the interventions they've received, but we don't have data yet to show is it really impacting the claims incidents. And the newest thing we're working on, and this is probably not going to, I put it here, be implemented in February. It looks like now it's going to be March, where we have some technical issues we're working through and implementing the electronic visit verification program. When you've got a block of business like this in long-term care, where you have, we have about 1,900 active home health care policies, and 60% of those are getting their home health care from private caregivers or family caregivers. You have to be very, very cautious and watch for fraud, waste, and abuse. We've only had 4 fraud cases nationally in Pinchcree since we started doing it 70 months ago. We have 1 in Texas. I find that kind of unreasonable. These are very hard to detect. Okay? Electronic visit verification, it requires the caregiver to log in and out using a smartphone or a tablet. If they don't have those, there is a telephony system that they can use, but there is geofencing involved. We can tell if that person leaves. We can tell that person is not there. Not only will it trim the reporting to stop what I call the bleed on benefits, where you're paying for benefits, you know, in 15 or 30 minute increments when the reporting was just sloppy, but also it could come up with some new fraud intervention. So, I'll report more, but I think the EBB is going to be a very, very good process. And Lincoln Memorial, I just wanted to comment. We are finished researching these policies. We're down to 26 active policies. And on the 26, there's only 3 of those that we think are, is it 3? Yeah, there's 3 top ones. 3 that we, no, 4. That we believe are, the people are still alive. We know that 3 policies had already been reported as deaths and just hadn't completed the documentation processing. Topping found 19 more by doing internet searches, such as findagrave.com. They've never been reported. So our next stage is going to be trying to reach out to those people to get in communication with them and try to deliver some benefits. But this is the point we're making at the end of an insolvency with a block of business like this. You have benefits, it's just not claimed. Other than that, I'll mention North Carolina Mutual. This is the newest insolvency. We became involved with it. October 31st, we were activated. And you can see here, the covered death benefits, about $600 million for the system, $11 million here in Texas. Covered cash surrender values in Texas, $1.15 million, $134 million nationally. So, we have not very many policies, only 1,178 life policies out of the 239,000. Here's the problem. North Carolina Mutual, out of that 240,000 policies, 90,000, they have no addresses. Okay. It's a messy block. And with those 90,000 with no addresses, who they get assigned to, the domiciliary state. As claims are incurred, we'll get better information. So those claims or the policies assigned to North Carolina might flow to other states. So we may have additional policies come Texas. But we've only had two batches of claims coming in the door. We paid out about $40,000 in benefits. So we're just getting started. And other than that, I went through the insolvencies pretty quickly, but there's not a lot to report to the board.
Any questions? On item number 14. I think that's you, still you, Bart.
Yep, financial matters. Jared, there are a couple of things here. Could you point out in the financial statements as of the end of November?
Yes. So we'll start there on 14.2 at the top. You'll see that's our normal quarterly reinvestment of U.S. Treasuries. They mature every quarter. We keep around $2 million and then reinvest what we don't need. That's our normal practice there. If you go to the notes in the middle of the screen, as Bart said, North Carolina Mutual was our newest insolvency. And he just told you we had roughly $11 million in covered benefits. So we initially booked those. You'll see that went up roughly $11 million. But then with our work with Eddie Meir in trying to refine our obligations, we came up with the process of booking the reserves rather than the covered benefits. And so there was a pretty dramatic change in November where those went down. So that impacted both the obligations on the liability side and the assets, the unbilled assessments on the asset side. Next page. This is the cash or the income statement result of that same issue with changing the obligations for North Carolina Mutual. You'll see the original $11 million came in, and then we took it right back out whenever we changed our process. And then down at the bottom of that, I don't think I've pointed this out before, whenever we do the reinvestment of the treasuries, we normally have a pretty big bump in the interest expense, and that is just a result of the new treasuries we buy. We normally have to pay accrued interest, and so that interest expense will bump up during that month. And I believe that's all the notes I have on the financial statements, unless there are any questions.
That's all for that, Jim. Unless there's questions.
Okay.
Should we move on to the budgets, operating and capital expenditure? What you have on this is the operating budget that we're proposing for 2023. Jared, I mean, we provided a lot of the assumptions and comparison of the change from 2022 that was extensive, several pages of write-ups of the materials. Is there anything there that you think you'd like to specifically point out for the board?
Can you full screen that?
I can.
Yeah, there's a couple items I'll touch on real quick.
Just hit the green.
First of all, just want to note that the increase in the budget from last year to this year is roughly $27,000, so not a huge increase.
You know, Jared, I'm going to do something real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
You still see that a little bit better?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so the first item there, the accounting and auditing, that's a fairly large increase due to the TDI audit that we're budgeting for. And just to let y'all know, at the end of this section, I have each one of these accounts with a description of the budget assumptions and the computation, so you can get more detail on those. Excuse me. The item education and training 5055, that went up from 4,900 to 10,400. It's a pretty big bump. That's just due to we adjusted and did a reclass in some of our conference and NOGA meetings, because some of those meetings do have an education and training component. So we've kind of split those. So part of that expense will go into education and training, and part of it will go into the conferences and NOGA meetings. And so that also explains why some of those expenses have gone down. The other big items we have on here, the 5060 employee benefits, there's three different items there. Those have all had pretty big jumps, along with the payroll taxes and the salaries. And that's obviously due to a new employee that we have. So those have gone up quite a bit. But opposite of that, the temporary personnel 5145 has gone to zero since we no longer have a temporary person. I don't really have any other items I wanted to point out, unless there are questions.
Jared, I want to talk about, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Dean, was that you?
On mute.
Well, let me point out that we have these two columns, the projected variable and projected fixed. We take the 2023 budget and try to point out which aspects of those budgeted numbers are driven by insolvency activities, because they're going to go up and down. And the piece of that, of course, are the national assessments. Those are the quarterly MPC fees and expenses we get from NOLGA. So you can see that $540,000 of the $2 million 2023 budget is a variable aspect. So we do track those throughout the year. Okay, any other questions on that? Jerry, real quick, tell them how much we're going to spend on capital expenditure.
Yeah, we have nothing for capital expenditure budget. We've not identified anything that we need to purchase this year, so it's nothing there.
Okay. So that's where we are. The compensation adjustments I discussed with the board during executive session are included in those budget numbers. And we'll take any questions. If there's no questions, Jim, we do have a resolution on the screen to consider.
We have a motion. We approve the.
This is Ted, so moved.
This is Dean. Well, this is Dean. I'll second it.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Resolution passes.
Next meeting.
Yeah, the next meeting. Tuesday, April 18th. If y'all could check your calendars.
Jim, I'd like to add something there while I'm looking at their calendar. And honestly, if something comes up and there's a conflict and we need to talk about this, let me know after the meeting. But I had mentioned that I thought there was a conflict, and actually was, in July. And I mentioned this to both the Assessment Investment Committee and the Personnel Committee. But I remedied that conflict. So if you look at your calendars, yes, the next meeting is April 18th, and the meeting after that will be on Tuesday, July 25th. So those are the next two board meetings. And with the board meeting in July being on the 25th, the Assessment Investment and Personnel Committees will be on July 18th. Okay. And Chair Lewis, that's all we have for today.
Is there anything else anyone needs to discuss? That's it. I'll adjourn the meeting. The time is 11:48 a.m. on January 24th, 2023. And this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that is held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned.